This is probably going to be a long one. I want to lay out for you all the ideas I have about ideation for your research project. A couple things to remind you of. Remember, the overall goal with this research project is to serve your clients by reducing uncertainty for them. There may be situations where you want to prove or disprove a specific hypothesis, but your mindset here is mostly serving clients by reducing uncertainty. Second, uncertainty in a low-stakes situation might be annoying or frustrating, but it's rarely costly. That's because, well, the stakes are low. You're playing poker with Monopoly money, not real money. So as you're responding to some of the ideation prompts that I'm about to walk you through, keep in mind the context. Ideas for reducing uncertainty in a low-stakes situation, or in the context of an easily reversed or easily changed decision, those ideas are less likely to be valuable to your clients than an ability to reduce uncertainty in a high-stakes situation, or in the context of a decision that is not easy to reverse or change. So as you're hopefully generating a list of ideas in response to some of these ideation prompts, you might pop them into a spreadsheet and add some additional columns where you rank each idea, perhaps based around how high the stakes are in the client situation that that idea relates to. Lastly, it's okay if you generate a ton of ideas, and it's okay if you generate only a few. Either way, you're going to need to prioritize the resulting list and arrive at one single idea to focus on for this research project. Just a word about these ideation prompts. I'm going to walk you through a bunch of questions. Some of them I'll add some additional context to. And there's going to be some redundancy in this list of questions. That's because the questions themselves are really just based on a few simple themes. First, how can you reduce uncertainty around important decisions for your clients? Second, how can you reduce consequential risk for your clients? And third, how could you create other efficiencies for your clients using data that you collect and interpret for them? So like I said, just a very few themes, but I'm going to expand those into a bunch of questions, and there's going to be a fair bit of variety in this basket of questions, and I think that variety is going to help you elucidate ideas that just those three themes won't. In other words, those three themes are so broad that they're not likely to spur thinking, but when they're turned into a bunch of very specific questions, they're more likely to, and that's why I have all these questions, but there's going to be a fair bit, as I said, of redundancy within them. Okay, on to the questions. First one, what causes or increases uncertainty for your clients? That's quite broad, I realize. But as you're working with clients, you can sort of notice this uncertainty. It's not difficult at all, in fact, to notice. Because when there's this sort of uncertainty around the decision, a number of things tend to happen. If you imagine everybody being in the same room together, all the heads sort of swivel or pivot at once to look at the most senior person in the room. What do they want to do? That's a signal, usually, that there's a fair bit of uncertainty. There's no institutional knowledge of how to make this decision, and so we just default to the hierarchy. The reverse sometimes happens, or the opposite sometimes happens, where it devolves into an endless sort of debate, and people are expressing opinions that might be very strongly held opinions, but they're opinions that aren't really backed up by anything that could serve to resolve the uncertainty. Another signal that you can notice is that procrastination sets in around the decision. That's another common signal that there's uncertainty afoot around this decision. And a variation of that would be avoidance. You see people just avoid making the decision which I suppose that's almost the same thing as procrastinating. But procrastinating is saying, oh, that's not as important. We'll get to it later when perhaps it actually is quite important. So procrastination is downplaying the need to do something in a timely fashion. And avoidance would simply be just saying, well, it doesn't matter, and just flat out avoiding it. Next question. What is the biggest risk to your clients? You might constrain this to things you could actually do something about, but I would not constrain this to your current level of involvement in your clients. So again, the question you're asking is, what causes or increases risk for your clients? Or what specifically are the risky parts of your work with clients? Now, if you don't even have a guess as to what this is, or you don't know what this is, meaning if you're saying, well, I just don't know what's risky and what's not, then I think that might be your research project is answering that question. Because if you don't know, that's not great, but maybe also your clients don't know, in which case there's an opportunity to help them execute better or plan better or make better decisions by understanding which decisions are risky and which are not. Now, if I were you and you currently do mostly implementation work, then I would assume that the research here will eventually gain you new access a few levels higher in the client organization. There's no guarantees, of course. But if you bake into your research the assumption that, okay, this research is going to open up new access higher in the organization, and it's going to help be a bridge out of doing implementation work, you bake that into your choice of topic, then the research that you actually do will be more likely to serve as a sort of bridge or an enabler of this new level of access higher in the client organization. So in other words, don't constrain your ideation. If you're doing just implementation work right now, don't constrain your ideation just to implementation work. Think bigger, think beyond just that. So as you're considering this question, what's the biggest risk to your clients? Think a little higher than you are right now. And when I say higher, I just mean a bit higher up the organization. Or if you think about it in the timeline of a project, if you get called in just for implementation work towards the middle and end of the project, think about how you might reduce risk if you were involved earlier in the project. Next question. What increases the return on investment for what you do? So as you're thinking about this, you might consider several sub-questions. Why do the kinds of projects that you work on with clients, why do they fail? So sometimes they fail. Sometimes they never get shipped. Sometimes they get shipped and they're a colossal disaster. These things happen, hopefully not very often, but they do happen. What makes those things happen? Why do these failures happen? Slightly less disastrous, why do projects underperform their potential? Why do they produce results that are less impressive or less impactful than they could have? So those are two why questions. Why do projects fail? Why do they underperform? Now that you have hopefully put some thought into those, ask yourself, what would function as some form of insurance against project failure or underperformance? In other words, what could be done? What decisions could be made differently? What could be known that was previously unknown in order to act as a sort of insurance policy against project failure or underperformance? Another way to phrase that might be, you know, there's plenty of things we cannot control. What can you control, or what could be done that's within your area of control that would produce better results or help projects produce better results? Then the same sort of thinking, but now we're not thinking about what's insurance that prevents harm, but what would act as a force multiplier or an accelerant, or would just simply improve the performance of the project, improve the results, improve the outcomes? Next question. What decisions do your clients make under high stakes and low data conditions? To expand that a little bit, where do you see your clients or prospects making decisions without good data or evidence or best practices to support those decisions, to enrich them, to make them better? Likewise, where do you see them making decisions based on bad data, bad evidence, or outdated or wrong best practices? Next question. Is there some sort of perennial question that your market tries to answer without evidence or data or useful models? Some of the signals that might alert you that this is going on, aside from the obvious one, which is you just see this question come up over and over again, and you sort of see people shrug their shoulders or say, I don't know, we just do it this way because we always have, or we do it this way because everybody does it this way, or something of that nature. But the signals are that there's no, you could think of it as an innovation process in some contexts, or you could just think of it as maybe design thinking, or there's just no roadmap to arrive at a decision that could be supported with evidence or data or something supportable. In other words, you see decisions being made or questions being answered, and if you were to challenge that person who made the decision or who came up with the answer or that group of people, if you were to challenge them on, why did you do this? They would struggle to say why. Or they would say something like what I alluded to earlier. Well, everybody does it, or competitor X is doing it and they seem to know what they're doing, or it seems to be working. There's this uncertainty about their answer to the question. There's a lack of confidence about their answer to the question. And it's better if these are not one-off questions, but perennial questions that seem to keep cropping up over and over again within your area of focus. Next question. Is there a problem that you are in love with, but you can't solve without data? Now, of course, we need to make sure this is not an unrequited love. You need to make sure that your market also loves this problem, or rather they crave a solution to this problem. I use the language in love with not at all accidentally, not at all casually. It's maybe about the best description of what it feels like to care deeply over a long period of time about something that you just care about. And if it's a problem that you could solve for your market that they are aware of, and they would fall in love with a solution to that problem. They don't probably love the problem because to them it's a problem, to you it's an interesting challenge. So they're not going to say, oh, I love that we just can't seem to make this thing work. But they would love a solution. And that's what I mean when I say, make sure it's not an unrequited love. Make sure you're not the only one who's in love with this problem and the solution that would come out of it, but rather make sure your clients also share that feeling. Next question. Where specifically do your clients do work that is sloppy, misguided, badly planned, or held back by errors or bugs, errors in judgment or errors in execution? On a pessimistic day, you might be a little frustrated. You might say, you know, my clients are just dumb. They're lazy. I hope that's not how you answer this question. Instead, try to adopt a more optimistic frame of mind. Your clients are almost always well-intentioned people acting without the support of good data or guidance. So your research is an opportunity to provide that missing data or guidance. Now, your clients can still reject it, but at that point, it's okay to call them lazy or dumb because they've rejected your brilliant insight. But don't start with that. Start with this optimistic idea of like, okay, they're trying their best. They could do better if they had better resources to work with. How can I create a resource that helps them do better work that's not so sloppy, misguided, badly planned, or held back by errors or bugs? Next question. What areas of technology or best practice do your clients feel like they are falling behind in? I want you to be careful about any kind of guesswork here. you're likely some sort of expert, and that expertise, hopefully aside from being very valuable to your clients, can also create bias. We all know the saying, to someone with only a hammer, everything looks like a nail. That's not, to me, a valid argument against specialization, but that is a very valid argument for self-awareness and understanding the limits of your expertise. So when you ask yourself, what areas of technology or best practice do I see my clients falling behind in? Make sure that you're not responding to some sort of evidence and not just assumptions. In other words, if you know someone could have a video camera perhaps concealed in a client's office or in a meeting with your point of contact and their supervisor or somewhere, if a video camera could possibly document this feeling that someone verbalizes at some point or writes up in an email or something, then you're probably on solid ground. But if you just have a sort of gut feeling or intuition, I want you to not totally discount that, but be aware that that might be coming out of your own bias. In other words, just to put that a little bit more simply, you know, a lot of us get really enthusiastic about our solution. And then that leads us to think, well, anybody who's not embracing our solution probably is feeling just so terrible about that. It probably keeps them up at night that they're not embracing our solution. They probably feel this deep sense of shame about not embracing our solution. Well, the truth is that they may not. They probably don't, in fact. They have their own set of concerns, their own very valid worldview for seeing things, their own awareness and lack of awareness about how awesome your solution is. So just don't get too into your own head when you answer this particular question. Next question. What specific area or areas of performance are upper management within your clients always complaining about? Now, this presumes some level of access to that upper management. But for example, if you had that access and you had the kind of trust to be able to be privy to these sorts of conversations, you might hear things like, oh yeah, our IT department just keeps embarrassing us. Like they just cannot seem to do something. Or, you know, our competition is just kicking our ass in some area. A way to think about this is to think about your point of contact, your buyer, the person who typically buys your services. Think about them at their year-end performance review. Where are they going to be told that they need to improve? Not necessarily personally, although that can be a very powerful source of motivation for a lot of people, but where do they need to improve the function or performance of the business unit that they're responsible for? Next question. What do you wish you could prove to clients or prospects? For example, in sales calls, you might realize that you're always saying this thing, but clients just don't understand how critical that thing is. Okay, that, depending on your specific situation, may lead you to just a long list of ideas. Again, be careful here because instead of proceeding from what the market wants and needs and expresses those needs to a conclusion, we're proceeding from us to a conclusion. So you want to be careful with this because, again, it's very easy to sort of start digging into your personal frustrations or your sort of personal preferences too much and start to come up with a list of things that you wish you could prove to clients, but just really don't make any difference to them. So as you think about this question, what do you wish you could prove to clients or prospects? Keep it grounded in things that actually would make a difference for them if you could prove it to them. Next question is very related. What do your clients push back about when perhaps you do make recommendations or you do say, this is how I think we should approach this? What do they push back about? Or what do you end up having a sort of, I'm going to say argue, but it may not be like an emotionally heated thing, but what do you debate about with them and wish that you could reach some sort of more objective agreement that's based on evidence or something other than who won the argument? As I'm going through my notes, I realize I have one super redundant question I said earlier, and I'm going to say it again, but in a different context. what specifically are the risky parts of your work with clients? And the earlier context was, what's risky for them? Like, what affects or diminishes or harms the outcome of the results you do for them? But now I want to give you permission to be totally selfish here. I want you to ask yourself, what poses a risk to your work specifically, not necessarily to the results your work produces for clients? So for example, maybe there's some area of uncertainty that causes your projects to go over scope a lot. So maybe you're doing them fixed price, so your client doesn't feel the pain, but you sure do. Or maybe you are sort of hustling and doing essentially unbillable work in order to make up the difference in the scope overage because you don't want your client to bear that cost and you decide to. So that would be an example of something that, okay, you could argue that you working under suboptimal conditions does affect the outcome, but maybe it doesn't actually. Maybe things just sort of work the way they're supposed to and you've just done a ton of extra work that you weren't planning on in order to make that happen. So here I'm giving you permission to sort of be selfish and think about how your ability to execute for clients, even if they never see sort of inside the factory, so to speak, how could your ability to execute for clients be improved with data or research? So what are the sort of personal unknowns or the personal risky parts of your work with clients? This research might be an opportunity to make that better. Last question. What new capability would represent some sort of 80-20 payoff for your clients? So what could they learn from your research that would produce outsized results for their business or the business unit that they're managing? So another way to look at this might be to say, what are the 20% of your client's cohort, meaning their competitors or other companies that they consider sort of similar enough that they would compare themselves to? What are the top 20% of that cohort doing that the rest aren't? You could even look outside of their self-identified peer cohort and ask, you know, what are the top performers in other fields doing that your clients could learn from? So here we've sort of, in terms of the ideas and research you might do, just thrown the doors wide open to the whole world. But the way we're constraining it is to say, what are top performers doing? Maybe there's an ability to sort of understand and characterize things that work elsewhere and import them to your client's world. Okay, that's it for the questions. I hope at least a few of these really get you thinking. If not, I would suggest just let things percolate in the back of your mind for a few days. Come back to the list, see if anything new has surfaced. I'd bet money that it has. Some of you are going to have a massive list at this point. Here's some ideas for ranking it. There are other ways, I'm sure, to do this, but I would do this in a spreadsheet. I'd have all the ideas in one column, and then I would add adjacent columns for these various ranking factors. I'm a big fan of ranking things on a scale of 1 to 3. As soon as you get to like a 5-point or a 10-point scale, you get into this sort of analysis paralysis world where you're like, is this a 4 or a 4.5 or 5? And also whole numbers only, no fractions, no decimals. So I would rank from 1 to 3. Of all these ideas I've generated, what do I think is going to have the greatest impact for my clients? I would give those a 3, and those that might have a lesser impact, a 2 or a 1. You might also think about which of these research projects seems like the easiest to execute on. So I would also rank that 1 to 3. And now I've got the ability to create this synthetic metric where I can multiply these two numbers, and a 3 and 1 and a 3 and the other is going to give a 9. And that's going to represent this nice combination of a lot of impact, but also easy for me to execute. And that might be a really valid way to prioritize and choose a winner out of these. It's not the only way. You could also say, which of these is just the most interesting to me? You definitely need some level of interest and enthusiasm, perhaps, to sustain you through the research. It's I mean, it depends. I imagine some of it could be done very quickly, but it's likely to be a sort of medium-term project. We're not talking about 1 or 2 months here. We're talking about a bigger time frame than that. So make sure that you're going to find it interesting. Maybe the actual research work itself won't be that interesting, might be a bit of a slog, but the knowledge that it would create, the insight that it would give you, the new clarity that it would create, if that's exciting to you, then that might be enough to kind of keep you going through it. The last way to start thinking about how to prioritize this is to say, okay, I've got these ideas. Which of them combine with a point of view that I have? So remember, a point of view is an opinion that you can support. And what better way to support that opinion than with research or data? So in an ideal world, the research would lead us to the point of view, not the other way around. But we don't live in an ideal world to start with, and we don't have to in order to create outsized value for our clients. So it's okay, I think, to say, okay, this is, you know, I have one or more things that I would call points of view, opinions that I would like to be able to substantiate and support in some way. So that might be a useful filtering mechanism, is you can say, okay, maybe I have 30 ideas I came up with. I'm going to filter them through my points of view and only keep the ones and put on a short list the ideas that correspond with some point of view that I have. Well, that's a nice way to get to the short list. And from there, you might use these other methods like ranking by impact and ease of execution to further narrow down the short list. Okay, that's it. I really hope this helps you start thinking about some ideas for what's the research you're going to do over the next 3 months in the Expertise Incubator. I'm going to follow this update up with a few more, this audio update, I'm going to follow up with a few more, some helpful ideas and examples of research out there in the world that I think will be useful to you, some thoughts on methodology, and some thoughts finally on augmenting how you go through the research.